organize us for inviting me. Explain how I think of the victory for anyone else. For me, I think stance of general relativity is left relativistic theory of gravity and a freeing from background structure. And there's a certain amount of difficulty in how you name different theories. You can use quantum GR there, quantum level, but then that does rather imply that the Einstein field equations are the equations for this. But one would want a word somewhat like quantum gravity that allows the theory to change.
Okay. So now the trouble with quantum gravity is that it's biased towards it being a relativistic theory of gravity rather than saying anything about it being a freeing from a background structure. There's not a name that I will use. And then one could use instead background independent quantum gravity that includes both the parts. But unfortunately, this is another kind of heresy, to me at least, because it involves the background independent and the gravity being separated by the quantum. So this is somewhat like a whether one splits the Trinity or not. So it can still be a matter of contention. If one believes that these two things come together, one would want these words to be grouped up. So I use quantum gestalt, where the gestalt means both of those things evenly. And do I use the initials QG, including an LQG, then I would take the Q and the G to stand for quantum gestalt. And then once one has this position, it becomes clear that this one is but one of two toy models that are each one half aspect, if you like, the Son and the Holy Ghost. So then it becomes possible, meaningful, to study quantum background independence without there being any presence of a gravity, let alone a relativistic gravity. And then comparing this to what various people do, a lot more people work on quantum gravity, meaning this aspect, than work on background independence, though in quantum geometrodynamics and in loop quantum gestalt, which I think a more relational name still would be not quantum gestalt, because the knots are reduced objects and the loops have redundancies. They've not taken out the diff redundancy yet. And then some ideas of M-theory, admittedly not others, are background independent in this way. And I would argue that Julian Barber and Bruno Bertotti's particle models, his triangle that he was talking about in the colloquium yesterday, can be set up to be a theory which is entirely of quantum background independence without any gravity in sight. So this quantum gestalt position makes things like that comparably valuable toy models to any sort of quantum gravity that treats it just as a relativistic theory of gravity without any thought of background structure. So it's some sort of complementary model to that. And then whenever one has quantum background independence, it essentially follows that there is the infamous problem of time, which is a notable conceptual and technical difficulty to deal with. So whoever thinks quantum background independence is a good thing then has to face this problem rather than run away from it or avoid it or try not to speak about it. So let's move on to relationalism itself. Now, relationalism is a one word which is used to mean many things. It can mean some very general things like relative to, although it shouldn't be confused with the theory of relativity. It's a different thing, the distinction Julian already made in his colloquium yesterday. It can also mean relations between things, perhaps. But in my approach and in Julian's, it mostly means the opposite of absolutism or the unnecessary background structures. So from this one deduces that when one is talking about relations between things, it's to mean physical things, or at least part tangible things, things that are part physical. On the grounds that gauge theory is useful, and that does have some redundancy. But one is interested in relations between things that have at least some physical content. As to unnecessary background structures, the issues are that they act that can't be acted upon, and that things that differ just in their background structure but not in anything tangible ought to be the same. This is Leibniz's identity of indiscernibles. So this is what I call the Leibniz-Marx-Barber sense of relationalism, and it's rather different from how that same word has been used by Rovelli and Crane. In my own version of this, it's much the same, but the number of postulates I have is slightly different. It does allow for me to import a small amount of Rovelli and Crane, but I also find that some Rovelli and Crane is in direct conflict with Leibniz-Marx-Barber, so that one has to choose one or the other. One can't have both of them at once, at least within the one model and the same regime or whatever. One can pick and choose for certain applications, but for complete generality, something that covers all the possibilities, one will have to make some choices between those two. And in the quantum gravity literature itself, the Rovelli and to some extent Crane forms of relationalism have appeared much more than the ones that Barber and I exposit. But in fact, the kind of relationalism that Barber and I exposit holds very widely in theoretical physics. It's only a misfortune or a convenience that the examples given in Julian's talk are always triangles and geometrodynamics. One could also do the Ashtekar approach in that kind of presentation at the classical level just as well. And there are fair indications that further sorts of theoretical physics can be thought of in these terms too. So although it isn't very often talked about, it does have enough width to be a foundational value to a number of subjects that don't currently acknowledge it. In this particular approach, Leibniz-Marx-Barber, time and configuration, and I take configuration to mean spaces and internal spaces together, the internal ones as in the sense of gauge theory, these two things are heterogeneous physical concepts, so each has its own notion of relationalism. So there's temporal relationalism on this slide, and there'll be configurational relationalism on the next one. And this, again, is similar enough to Julian's talk, although there may be a few small differences and generalities. In temporal relationalism, one starts with Leibniz. This is where the history of the subject of this conference so far I take to start, although one could look for more ancient roots than that, but pretty ancient one compared to most of the rest of the things on the board there. And Leibniz's take on time is that there's no time for the universe as a whole. This is to mean that time is not a primary entity. And this means then that because we see time, or think we see time, see something which is like time around us, that we need to get our time from somewhere. And this is then resolved by Marx's input, which is that time is to be abstracted from change. And this means that time is an emergent phenomenon rather than a primary one. So these two are mutually consistent. And the issue then, there's quite a lot to do with what's in this talk, is which change is meant in time is to be abstracted from change. As to implementing Leibniz with some mathematics, because this isn't just philosophy, these particular statements can be written in concrete mathematical form. Leibniz timelessness is implemented by manifestly reparametrization invariant, or as I prefer to call them in the case where there aren't any lambdas at all because they cancel out, manifestly parametrization irrelevant actions. And although the most common one is the one that Julian wrote yesterday, which has this TV square root and manages to have its parametrization invariance because this is quadratic, and then there's a square root, so the d by d lambdas here are squared, but square rooted and thus cancel with these. A more general form for this has the Lagrangian bihomogeneous of degree 1. And then in particular, one can have a T-linear outside where the dependence is linear, and you have a cancellation like that. And that allows for relationalism, as Julian presented it, to include fermionic species as well, so that that sort of a development of physics doesn't hinder the development of this relational approach. It can be included. There being no primary time, as per Leibniz, means there's no primary notion of velocity. And the notion of momentum is then not to be defined as a derivative with respect to velocity, but in terms of this arc element instead. And having an arc element like this means that one is modeling a geometry. And if it's a geometry that just has the root TV form, It's a Riemannian geometry. But if it's a more general homogeneous thing, of which that's one example, when it has the T-lin, it's more like a Finslerian geometry than a Riemannian one. And in this approach then, there being no primary time, all that one is really talking about is changes in the queues, the configurations, relative to changes in the other queues. And then, in fact, it's some combination, often taken to be at least in principle D of all the queues, that serves as an emergent time, and furthermore, as a simplifier of the dynamical equations of motion. And Julian covered all that yesterday in slightly less generality for the case of a triangle and for geometric dynamics. Then there's configurational relationalism. So I say spatial relationalism and internal relationalism as one has in engaged theory. Key concept is one has a configuration space Q. And furthermore, Julian takes this to be primary. And most of his physics is based on Q and bundles over Q and things like that. We shall generalize that slightly in a bit. There is also a group, and the group acts on the Q. And it acts in such a way that there's no physical difference according to what the G does. So that's something like rotations in the case of the triangle, and something like three diffeos in the case of geometric dynamics. And then one passes through a sequence from Q to some kind of bundle over the configuration space, and that looks like one is going in the wrong direction, introducing more redundancies. But then this G, it's encoded by auxiliaries, also called G, but little g, and variation in respect to the little g's produces constraints that are first class, and those constraints then use up 2 degrees of freedom each, so one ends up on the quotient space, which is where one wanted to be, no redundancies. And this is then a reduced configuration space, although, at least for some of the simpler theories, we shall be seeing that one can formulate this without doing the best matching and going by the indirect procedure. At least for some of the easier models, one can formulate this directly, in which case there's not been any reducing going on. So I don't call it reduced configuration space, because it's only one of those according to one of the two paths by which I get to it. The other way, I get to it directly, and so I call it a relational configuration space rather than just a reduced one. And what I say for these particular examples holds for 1 and 2 dimensional relational particle models with and without scale. So that's the Barber-Bertotti ones or the Barber-03 dynamics of pure shape ones. For those models, applying the reduction process to Barber's theory, which is formulated indirectly using best matching, is equivalent to doing the Jacobi-Singh construction on geometries provided by Kendall, who I shall introduce on my next slide. This is a standard procedure for constructing a mechanics given a geometry. The geometry serves as the configuration space geometry for the mechanical theory. And in fact, Kendall knew what the configuration space was for Barber's triangle before Barber formulated the theory of the triangle, but he did not identify it as some sort of mechanics because he didn't do the Jacobi-Singh construction. He was a statistician. See if I get him the right way up. Here we are. This is David George Kendall. He studied the statistics of shape, and the notion of shape itself that he had was exactly the same as Julian's, which is why those two approaches to mechanics on the previous slide gave the same mechanics in the two-dimensional cases for which they can both be worked out. And he was, in fact, Cambridge's first professor of statistics and was described in his obituary as the founding father of British probability. He was a well-known figure, but he's apparently not known among theoretical physicists. So he studied what turned out to be the configuration space for Julian's theories, the ones of particles, triangles, quadrilaterals, tetrahedrons, whatever. He studied that in complete generality and built a theory of statistics on that, which can be used to ask questions like, how probable is it that these quasars in this sample of the sky are aligned? Or how probable is it that these monoliths that have been found were set up by ancient people to stand in straight lines? It might be that someday this statistical theory of shape would form a classical records theory as well, but that's beyond what I can do at the moment, and certainly doing the quantum version of that is something that is outside of my current scope. Okay, let's see. No, I've gone the wrong way. There's still one slide here. It's an important one. No, two slides. Okay, yes. Temporal relationalism and configurational relationalism can be composed so that your theory has both of them at once. However, to do so strictly, you don't want to use auxiliaries like the omega zero as corrections to the velocities, because that breaks the manifestory parameterization invariance. One wants to use dotted variables instead. So instead of multipliers, one has the velocities associated with cyclic coordinates, or possibly differentials, where the lambdas have been cancelled out throughout and the manifestly parameterization irrelevant form. And then, in fact, free endpoint variation ensures that the equations of motion are not affected by this change from multipliers to cyclic coordinates. The equations read the same. And this means that for us now, strictly speaking, the electric potential is really the time derivative of some more primary relational quantity. And likewise, the shift is really a dot of a more primary quantity. And in this particular case, I'll name it as the velocity of the frame when it has the dot. So it's the frame itself that's the variable. That makes quite a lot of good sense in terms of the dimensions of the quantities and so on. That's a distinct possibility, but it was never made explicit in the older formulations. So, in fact, more generally, relationalism has quite a colorfully different set of principles of dynamics. As well, once one has this, instead of appending constraints with multipliers, one appends them with cyclic velocities instead. And instead of a Hamiltonian, one has an almost Hamiltonian, from which all the physical Q dots have been eliminated, but the auxiliary G dots are allowed to remain within it. And then there's an almost Dirac procedure instead of a Dirac procedure, and there's a notion of almost phase space, which is phase space for all the physical degrees of freedom, but is allowed to contain velocities of auxiliaries amongst its auxiliary coordinates, whilst it's presented redundantly. So there's a new form of principles of dynamics that's needed for these theories. And then we go back to the examples Julian gave, we'll pick out some slightly different features of them. And I shall warn you at this point that the talk is trouser-shaped. And now we've reached the crotch of the talk, I guess. Or more politely, the point of a non-Hausdorffness. So from here, we shall go in one direction and explain relationalism more generally, and then we'll come back and show you how you can solve the triangles and the quadrilaterals using fairly standard math, so it takes a while to find it. But for the moment, I give the examples. One of the things is an analogy between the configuration spaces one has for these triangles or generalizations and the ones that one has for general relativity, which are more widely known. So it's a space of relative separation that's analogous to the ream of three metrics. And then there is a pre-shaped space, which is analogous to the pointwise ream. And there is a relational space, which is analogous to superspace. And this one is reached by taking out the three diffeos. That one is reached by taking out the rotations. And if one takes out dilatations and rotations at once, one passes to the shape space. And then there's a way of lifting the shape space off by a coning procedure to form the relational space again. So here those two are the same. But here, if you do that, you find that you don't get back to superspace, because that's introducing a global one, whereas that was getting rid of a local one. So in that case, one gets to CS plus V. So there's a certain sense in which relational space is like CS plus V, and there's a certain sense in which relational space is like superspace. And that's because it's only a finite model, so it doesn't have a difference between a finite and an infinite notion of scale. And then in each case, one has an action of that square root form. Here it's just a flat mass metric. Here it's a DeWitt supermetric. And then one has an analogy between an energy constraint here and the GR Hamiltonian constraint. And then between the GR momentum constraint and something like the total angular momentum of the universe is zero. There are a few other constraints, especially if one does a scale invariant theory. There's also a dilatational constraint, which is analogous to a maximum slicing. And in each case, one has an emergent time. And the thing that these models, like Julian's triangle, are particularly useful for modeling are two aspects of midi superspace that are not included among the aspects of mini superspace. Namely, it has a non-trivial linear constraint. And it also, even in 1D, has a non-trivial notion of clumping, i.e. inhomogeneity or structure, and then cosmological structure formation. So those are the things that those models will be good for. On the other hand, they're not so good for some other things because they don't have GRs in definite kinetic terms. They don't have GR-specific potentials. They're not field theories. They don't involve diffeos and so on. So for some purposes, they're useful, and for some others, they are not. Something that I shall return to once we start studying those. I'll give a result now, which is not really part of the talk, but comes from some of what we said yesterday. This is my own result about fixing lambdas and things like that. Flavio Mercati presented a result that had the dot of the Hamiltonian constraint require either lambda equals 1 via a factor like this, or have some other factor like that that requires a CMC slicing. However, I showed that if the kinetic term takes this form with a parameter allowed to be out on the front, and there's a cosmological constant type term allowed as well, then there are two further possibilities. It could also be that the coefficient of the Ricci's is zero, which gives the Strong or Carroll regime and corresponds to a C equals zero relativity. Or it could be that you're letting this thing blow up by having this term be zero, in which case one gets a Galilean relativity. So in fact, there are four families of consistent theories that come out of the propagation of the H dot, one of which is the lambda equals one, two of which are rather strange for most everyday purposes, and the last of which is a preferred slicing condition. And that was derived, for instance, in that paper there. You can add that to your notes from various talks yesterday. Okay, so now I shall develop relationalism further. So far what I've said is much the same as what Julian had, but I shall now add some more axioms of my own. Relationalism doesn't allow you to associate whatever G you please with the given configuration space. Firstly, the group G cannot have so many redundancies in it that it completely kills all the degrees of freedom in the Q. So it's dimensionally constrained. But additionally, we need the Q and the G to have some level of structural compatibility. So if one is taking out diffeos from a ream, it had better be for the same underlying three topology, or at least something closely related, so that it has a natural group action and so on. And furthermore, the Dirac procedure allows for certain sorts of Gs to be rejected or modified. For instance, one cannot insist on having ream and having not the diffeomorphisms, but just the identity as the group of physically irrelevant transformations. If one does that, one finds that one gets the momentum constraint anyway as an integrability, a result that was first found by Teitelbaum in 1973. And there are other possibilities involving complete inconsistency, and the best example of an inconsistency coming out of a principles of dynamics procedure is this one. Dirac says, if L equals X, then dL by dx dot d by dL of is zero, but dL by dx is one. So calling something an action, which would be to put integrals around this, does not mean that the equations that follow from it are consistent. And that is one means by which certain groups can be rejected by certain configuration spaces. And that is much of what happened in that relativity without relativity paper, which was the basis of Flavio's talk yesterday. Next, as well as studying a configuration space Q and possibly regarding it as primary, and studying this at the classical level, there are five directions in which you want to develop your physics, I believe, beyond that. At least there's a fair chance you need all of these. You might debate whether some of them are necessary structures. One of them is to consider not only the configuration space Q, but also the morphisms associated with it, i.e. the point transformations between different coordinatizations of the configuration space. Another one is uplifting the Q to the phase space. Another one is considering the set of subsystems of the Qs. And another one is considering the set of propositions about whatever else one is talking. And finally, one can quantize. So one can do all of that at the classical level or at the quantum level. And these five ways of expanding on the previous treatment of relationalism, which are centered on the Q, can be combined among themselves. Or particularly sensible combinations might include that you take the phase, and then you categorize that, so you associate it as morphisms, and they're the canonical transformations, and then you apply quantization to that. That's one well-known combination. Another one is that you're often interested in the propositions that concern physical subsystems. But the whole lot of these things can be combined up, and that allows you to get at all the other physics and all the other machinery about answering the questions that physics should be about. And I claim that I've found a relational version for each of these, how one can do each of these moves and combine all of these moves within a Leibniz-Mach-Barber sort of relationalism. But unfortunately, this talk is by no means long enough to include that. But it's in the paper I put on the archive a couple of days ago, this one, 1205-1256. At the quantum level, relational theories give frozen quantum mechanics, like the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, for instance, a stationary equation, rather than time-dependent quantum mechanics. If the relational theory is formulated in an indirect way, so it's been best matched and then not reduced, then there'll be quantum constraint equations around as well. And in fact, both reduced and Dirac-type approaches to quantization are relational in the Leibniz-Mach-Barber sense. Passing to the quantum level gets rid of a lot of differences between relational formulations and non-relational formulations, e.g. between actions of this form and actions of the more common Euler-Lagrange form. Now, those are different, but they pass to very similar Hamiltonians. And then when one quantizes those up, then one gets things that are much more similar. So many of the implementations of relationalism at the classical level get wiped out in the passage to the quantum level. But the principles of temporal relationalism and configurational relationalism are reapplicable at the quantum level, so that one can ensure that all the procedures that one does there comply with those, but one may need to find new implementations in order to do so. But in the paper I cite, those are provided. And then quite a lot of problem of time facets get tied up to aspects of a relationalism. So I should start by saying what the problem of time facets are and what the main strategies are before I use relationalism as a selection principle on them to promote some of them over others. So I've said already that we have frozen equations, and there's often an ensuing inner product problem that's taken to be part of that. The other aspects of the problem of time, one of them is usually known as the thin sandwich formulation, but relationalism recasts it as what is named after Julian's best matching as a best matching problem. So that one generalizes this one. There's also a foliation dependence problem that in classical GR, moving between the two green surfaces via the two blue ones is physically equivalent to moving via the two red ones in terms of what is seen on the later hypersurface. Then there's a functional evolution problem, which essentially means that if the classical constraint algebra closes, it doesn't imply that the quantum one does. So it's a subset of anomaly physics. But it's that subset of anomaly physics where the anomalies have something to do with time or possibly to do with frames. There's also a multiple choice problem that choosing different times can lead to inequivalent quantum theories, even if the times were themselves canonically related at the classical level. And there's the global problem of time, that the notion of time may not be valid everywhere. And there's the problem of beables, which is usually called the problem of observable. And this is usually taken to require one's observables to commute both with the linear constraints and with the Hamiltonian constraint. Although some versions don't include the second equation, and some versions would not require the object to obey either of those, but then we'll have more explaining to do in that case, and we'll come on to that. And the final one of the eight facets of the problem of time is the space-time reconstruction or replacement problem. With space-time not being a primary notion in many quantum, canonical quantum approaches, then one ends up having to try to reproduce it at the end in a suitable limit. And this is where loop quantum gravity tends to get stuck at the moment. I argue that all of those are parts of the problem of time, and unless you can defeat all eight of those, you're not solving the problem of time. You're only solving some part of it. And there are which strategies you use to go around the problem of time. For better or for worse, these are usually concentrated, centered around how one goes about unfreezing the theory. Of course, it might be logical if there's eight facets that you want to strategize centered about each of them in turn. And so this traditional classification may not have much future. But it's how the subject is still organized for the time being. The equations of physics might have no time in them because the time is hidden inside them. Or possibly it needs appending, for instance, by introducing some sort of reference matter. Another possibility is that there's a classical time that emerges from the totality of change, and that's the Marchian Jacobi Barber Bertotti time, which was talked about in Julian's colloquium talk yesterday. Another possibility is that there's no time classically, but there's time in some regimes where semi-classical conditions apply, and it emerges there. And that's a WKB time. And then it turns out that, at least a fairly good approximation in a number of settings, the Jacobi Barber Bertotti one and the WKB one are the same, or approximately the same. And that's significant because this one by itself doesn't unfreeze the equations of physics. So it doesn't serve the main function of a problem of time of resolving approach. But then a similar object is constructed from a semi-classical scheme where there is a bona fide unfreezing. Then a final possibility is the equations appear to have no time in them because they have no time. So then the issue is, what questions can be answered by physics that contains no time? And that is the subject, for instance, in the naive Schrodinger interpretation of Hawking and Page, or the conditional probabilities interpretation of Page and Wouters, and various things that are called records theory, which would include Julian's time capsules and various ideas of Gell-Mann and Hartle and Halliwell and myself. And that's a fairly heterogeneous subject, so we don't agree as to what the axioms of this are for the moment. And then a final possibility is that there's no time because time is no longer a useful concept. The useful concept is to be histories. And that, of course, is a Hartle's approach and Eichmann Linden's. And finally, there's another sort of a timelessness, which has a number of technical differences from the set of timelessnesses I describe here, which is Rovelli's notion of timelessness, the evolving constants of the motion and the partial observables type of approaches. So those are the strategies that one has. So then the idea is to judge the previous two slides using Leibniz and Marx's time principles. And this comes back to that thing which I said was going to be central to this talk. In Marx's postulate, time is to be abstracted from change. Well, time is to be abstracted from what change? There are various answers to this what that are given by different people. Rovelli has argued that it can be time is to be abstracted from any change. On the other hand, Barber, and it's quite a Leibnizian statement, has said time is to be abstracted from all change, i.e. the totality of change in the universe. Whereas I argue somewhere in between the two, although mine is the blue dot position, which is somewhat closer to Julian's position than it is to Carlo's position, but it still lies somewhere in between the two. My position is that enough locally relevant change is the amount of change that one should include. And I argue that although Julian argues that his approach reflects what the astronomers do for determining time, that in practice the astronomers only consider a number of fairly close by bodies, typically the Earth, Moon, Sun system, or something like that. So that this is a more concrete, accurate realization of what the astronomers do anyway. So I call mine a generalized local ephemeris procedure after the ephemeris type times of astronomy, which I view as a family of procedures rather than a unique one. Now, this attitude and this attitude both have lessons for each other from which both of them can be made stronger. Any change is quite a natural position, a democratic position in the generic case, where there aren't nice things like the Earth, Moon, Sun system around so that one can establish an accurate time standard. Yes?
Suppose I made a clock that ran backwards and gave that to Rovelli as my any change. What would he deduce from that?
I guess he would use minus the reading on it as a monotonically increasing function. And he would then attempt to determine the motion of other things in terms of, relative to the motion of this object of yours that was running backwards.
The minus wouldn't bother him?
I don't think the minus would bother him.
But wouldn't it also just be saying your watch is going anti-clockwise instead of clockwise?
Possibly. In terms of configurations, it might be difficult to tell whether a clock is moving forwards or backwards. It depends what it displays. I mean, if it was a watch hand, then you could be looking at your watch hand in the mirror or something like that. But if it was a digital display, then it would be obvious it was running backwards. Yes?
Isn't the real problem running forward for a while?
Yes, that's more of a problem if it goes in both directions. Yes, yes, that can be more of a problem. But If one's motion is doing that, one still may be able to extract the time from it, for instance, if it's a regular motion. You could take a forward swing and a backward swing to be your unit of time if it kept on doing similar ones. But there's no accuracy claim. This is the problem. In the other approach, in Julian's or mine, it's implicit that sometimes are better than others, which is the opposite of a democracy. It's a time oligarchy. And even in the generic case, one can still try multiple things as time functions and see which of them happens to give more accurate predictions when it is used as the time that features in one's dynamical equations. So just because there isn't something like the Earth, Moon, Sun system around that's nice and obvious to use, that doesn't preclude the idea that some are better than others and that active testing can lead you to find which is one. And that's what I mean by enough locally relevant change. If you live in a universe where there's only slight inhomogeneities or something like that, and you have no more changes than that, then you might have to consider quite a lot of inhomogeneities to make your enough locally relevant change. If your time standard is to reach a certain accuracy, but that's included within having a procedure like this. So this.
How do you determine the accuracy of the time standard with other time standard characters?
By how well it predicts the motions that it's meant to predict. So one might consider that, say, the rotation of the Earth as a clock, and then try to predict the position of the Moon, assuming that the Earth's rotation was usable as a giver of the Newtonian time. And then if one found that the Moon wasn't where one expected it to be according to one's calculations, one might then choose to blame the irregularities of the rotation of the Earth and then seek to include more changes than just the rotation of the Earth, for instance, the relative Earth-Sun position, and then see if including that as well produced a time standard that allowed you to predict more accurately where the Moon was, and to keep on doing that until one achieves the accuracy that one desires. Okay, now let's judge some time standards. Okay, now I don't like the York time because the York time is the same regardless of what the matter content in the universe is. So it doesn't allow matter changes to have the opportunity to contribute to the time standard. And I'm against matter time as well, largely, especially in the cases where it's unphysical or unobservable because that leaves it untangible. But also because the other parts of the system that are not the matter-time itself can't contribute if the time is entirely set by some sort of reference fluid. And then scale times are particularly bad because they only involve one degree of freedom too. On the other hand, the Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti time allows for all the changes. In fact, has currently formulated all the bosonic changes, although using actions like the one I've either rubbed out or covered, using actions like this eventually leads to a procedure where the fermions can feed into it perturbatively or something like that. So it's sort of sorted out. But the trouble with this one, as I said before, is that it doesn't unfreeze the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So it isn't enough by itself. Then there's the WKB time. In that semi-classical approach, if you do it to sufficient accuracy, including enough terms as corrections, then any part of the universe's changes can contribute to that time standard. So it's a suitably Markian. And then in attitudes to semblance of time from in timeless approaches, those are also classifiable by Julian's all or Carlo's any or my sufficient totality or whatever. But that's and that even suggests new schemes outside of the existing list of schemes, because some of those schemes have interesting properties but don't have the right attitude to time, so they can be made more Markian. That's probably the subject for another talk. And then finally, various things like the WKB or Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti time can be used as the time standards in history's theory. So I have a tendency to select these approaches. Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti at the classical level, semi-classical time, certain sorts of timelessness where the attitude to semblance of time is suitably Markian, and history's theory. And it turns out that these are fairly universal as to which theories they apply to. They don't depend on very specific features of the field equations, whereas York time is not necessarily a time for alternative theories of gravity and so on. So these are also nicely universal. And they furthermore are all theories that can be modeled non-trivially using Julian's triangle or other relational particle models. And that kind of explains why I studied those, because they fit the approaches that I believe in. And these approaches can often be combined to cure each other's ills. As to the problem of time facets, temporal relationalism is now the philosophical principle. Reparametrization invariance is the mathematical implementation of that rather than an explanation in its own right in this approach. And it leads, as usual, then to the Hamiltonian constraint, which is purely quadratic, and then that leads to a frozen equation like the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So the frozen facet of the problem of time goes right back to Leibnizianism. Then configurational relationalism implies the linear constraints, and then solving these in their Lagrangian form for the auxiliary variables of the associated group is the best matching procedure. And doing that in the case where one is trying to solve to get rid of the shifts in geometric dynamics was the thin sandwich, and that turned out to be a thin sandwich problem because it turned out to be a particularly badly behaved partial differential equation. So the best matching procedure is a generalization of the thin sandwich. So it's a better and more general understanding of one of the eight facets of the problem of time. Then these constraints that relationalism provide, one is then to look at an algebra of commutators of those, and that is leading to functional evolutional problems whenever those have anomalies in them which are time related. Also, there's the foliation dependence issue, and there is GR has a good way of solving all three of these at the classical level. Space-time reconstruction at the classical level is the relativity without relativity result that we were lectured about yesterday. The foliation dependence is avoided by the Dirac algebra, and the Dirac algebra closes classically as well. So classically, there's nothing like the anomalies. The trouble is that at the quantum level, none of these things are known to be reproducible. So all of those then become bad problems at the quantum level. But they're all very much related to the objects, the constraint objects that come out from the two relationalisms. Then there are various attitudes to the problem of observables or of beables. There's the Kukash attitude that commuting with a linear constraint suffices, and there's the Dirac attitude that all the constraints are needed. And Barber and Foster have argued in favor of the Kukash approach, and that largely has to do with not regarding the Hamiltonian constraint as a generator of gauge transformations. It counts as a different kind of object in that kind of approach. On the other hand, in Ravelli's approach, one doesn't require the objects that one considers, the partial observables, to commute with any of these things. One merely looks for correlations between the objects, even if the objects by themselves are not physical. So those, just like Ravelli's times, are much easier to find because a much wider class of objects are suitable candidates. But then one has further explaining to do later on down the line. There aren't any particular ties between multiple choice problem and global problem and relationalism of the Barber kind. There are some attitudes, though, like any time will do is more conducive to thinking about multiple choice, possibly, because then it's obvious that there'll be more than one time. And also then one isn't surprised if a time isn't global and one has to change to a different time in a neighboring patch. So it may be that Ravelli provides slightly more intuitions and more scope for dealing with these problems. But there isn't much there that's concrete yet. Let's see. I'll quickly give the account of what the Ravelli-Crane approach has. It has the use of anything as a time for anything else, which we've already discussed, and the partial observables that we've already covered. There's two other postulates which are accommodable alongside Leibniz-Mach-Barber relationalism. One is that quantum mechanics only makes sense for subsystems. I dispute the only, I would include the whole universe too, but it is inclined to placing importance on results concerning subsystems. And the other one concerns how to model observers observing other observers observing subsystems. So those are two aspects that are not covered in Leibniz-Mach-Barber relationalism, but seem to be useful further thoughts that could be incorporated into such a program without causing clashes. On the other hand, this one clashes with sometimes are better than others using the totality of times and so on, using the totality of change in the universe and so on. So one has to choose between Leibniz-Mach-Barber and Ravelli for this one. And likewise here, Ravelli would favor partial observables, whereas relationalism would favor Kukash or possibly Dirac ones. So it's a choice to make rather than two programs that are just joined up. Okay. I'll now have a quick go at how one solves the triangle model. This is the other leg of the pair of trousers. So when one is modeling quantum Gestalt, the best one can do is one can model little patches of information, much like one has a number of charts on a manifold. A mini superspace covers certain aspects, and these relational particle models cover other aspects, and 2 plus 1 gravity covers yet other aspects. It's true, mini superspace covers more aspects, but it's harder to solve anyway, so it's more difficult to make progress. And the first step in solving something like Julian's triangle is to note that the relative separation variables of Lagrange aren't much use. One much prefers to use relative separations between particle clusters, which are Jacobi coordinates. And that was very obvious to me because once upon a time I was interested in theoretical chemistry, and that certainly uses constructions like this, although they also appear in celestial mechanics. The point of these is that they diagonalize the kinetic term once one has taken out the translations. In fact, they make the action look exactly like it looked before for the cues, but for one object less, so that one has something that looks exactly the same with the translations or without the translations. The next step involved Kendall's work. There are only 3 simple periods of spaces, configuration spaces, reduced shape spaces, at the topological level. One-dimensional particle models, their shape spaces are the spheres. Two-dimensional ones, which are the n-agons, of course, their configuration spaces are complex projective spaces. And there's also another diagonal with spheres along there. However, this diagonal, where Kasson showed they were spheres, turns out not to continue to be simple at the metric level. So we're left with these two things here being the only ones that one can model simply. And then the point is that there's about 110 analogies between one and two-dimensional models like the triangle and geometric dynamics. So they're already more than good enough without going to dimension 3. It's 3D, 3 plus 1D geometric dynamics that's being modeled by 2D particle models. So it's not modeling a trivial geometric dynamics either. And there's no point in modeling something hard by something that's also hard and has an unrelated source of hardness, like the 3D n-body problem. So the 2D n-body problem has the nice advantage that it's soluble. What happens at the metric level? Those spheres, one can find spherical coordinates for them, and those diagonalize them, and that allows for subsequent obvious classical and quantum calculations. On the other hand, if one is working with the triangle, one finds that it's the first CP1 space, so it's S2, and that makes it very easy as well. But for the quadrilateral, one has to use non-trivial complex projective space character. So one is stuck using a Fibini-Studi metric, and in fact, one can't diagonalize it. The best one can do is use Gibbons Pope coordinates that have this block form. And then if one considers a pentagon or higher, then not even the analog of this is known. So the working becomes somewhat constrained along there. Doing detailed calculations is really restricted to these families, the triangles, the quadrilaterals, and n particles on a line. If one wants to model these with scale, because those were pure shape spaces, then one can do a cone construction. So one considers the cone over the shape space, and some of those cones are very easy. The cones over the spheres are just real spaces. The cone over the complex projective spaces, however, is its own space and requires its own treatment. But it's still relatively doable. The next key is finding coordinates for the scaled ones. It's very easy to use the magnitudes of the Jacobi coordinates for the case of the 1D models. But for the 2D models, there's a problem. There are 4 natural components of the Jacobi vectors, and yet the scale space is the cone over S2, which is R3. So how do you go from 4 to 3? The trick, in fact, turns out to be that you need to use a Hopf map in between to slip between them. And that means that now, instead of having something as obvious as that as the coordinatization, one has a dot product, a cross product, and the difference of 2 squares. And those are the Dirac coordinates, although they're already familiar from the form of the Hopf map. And that turns out to be the kind of mathematics that one needs here. And then this past year, I worked out the equivalent of this set for the quadrilateral. Let's move one up. The next thing is, one can decorate the configuration space spheres by the physical interpretation. So for instance, DD is a double-double collision. So 2 collide here and 2 collide somewhere else. The T is a triple collision. The E is the equilateral triangle. The I is the line of isosceles. The D is a double collision. The C is a collinear. So then the classical motions are paths on this. So one can just paint what the solution is on here and read off what the physical interpretation is. And one can do something similar for the quadrilaterals, except now it's a CP2 space that's four-dimensional, so it's harder to envisage. Got about 2 slides left. Okay, 2 minutes, that's about right. Okay, so the next key is the isometry groups. For the spheres, they're just SONs, and that's nice. But it turns out that for the n-agons, where they were complex projective spaces, the isometry groups of those are also well known. They're SUN over some discrete ZN. In particular, then, for the quadrilateral, it's SU3 over Z3. So whilst SO3, which is what you get for triangles and four particles on a line, then gives you a type of mathematics which is well known from molecular physics, this one gives you mathematics that's well known from particle physics. In particular, that's exactly the same group as the one has for color. So I showed on the basis of this how to interpret isospin and hypercharge for a relational quadrilateral, which conserved quantities those are. So conserved quantities, of course, are very conducive to solving things. One can then solve the equations at the classical level and at the quantum level. For free motions, one just has geodesics on those spheres. For harmonic oscillator potentials, then there are various possibilities. For the triangle, you end up with one well combinations being particularly simple, but for four particles on a line, it ends up with two wells, so there's the opportunity for tunneling between those. Kinematical quantization of these models turns out to be a subcase of an example in Eichen's 1984 review. Conformal operator ordering turns out to be relationally motivated. That's the same as Misner's ordering. And then one can write down well-known time-independent Schrodinger equations for the triangle, say. And then one can reinterpret well-known quantum solutions in relational terms. So, for instance, one gets spherical harmonics in the free case, and here's one of the well-known d orbitals. This says it's probable I'm equilateral, it's probable I'm collinear, and it's improbable I'm somewhere in between that. So it's now obviously a statement about shapes. And then finally, one can do perturbation theory about that, and that gives you a model of the Halliwell-Hawking scheme for quantum cosmological perturbations. And these problem of time facets, many of them are simplified in these models, so you can make some progress with solving problem of time strategies here. So it's a testing ground for those. They manifest the frozen formalism problem. On the other hand, that reduction or formulation directly of Kendall's amounts to solving the best matching problem for relational particle models. Not being GR space-time-like, they don't have foliation dependence. They also don't have a reconstruction problem. They also have the good fortune of not having an evolution problem from their easy maths. The problem of observables is solved in these cases. The observables for the pure-shaped triangle are the shapes themselves. Those are Kukac observables for it. And then there's the particular construction that can be made for Dirac observables following some work of Halliwell's. The multiple choice problem and the global problem of time are still manifested by these, and it's not so clear what to do. One possibility is trying to use something like Boyer-Waldetel's patching to resolve that, but I've not dealt with it yet. But elsewise, 6 of the 8 facets are either absent or conquered for Julian's triangle. And then which strategies can be done? The last slide. Well, there's some strategies that I decided that were not particularly Machian, so I won't talk about those. I'll concentrate on those that can be done. The emergent time was presented by Julian yesterday, and I now assert that I've done calculations for, or at least know how to do calculations for in that case, but for the rest of them, I've done calculations for Julian's triangle studied as a semi-classical system, a naive Schrodinger interpretation system, a record system, a history system, and various combinations of those like Halliwell's and Gambini-Porto-Pulland. And I believe in principle I can study Ravelli's observables here as well. And in fact, they have an analog of York time that I call Euler time that has this dilational object in analogy to that one. So they have a good number of problem of time strategies that can be studied there. So Julian's triangle, I believe, is and will be as successful as mini superspace as a model for such things as problem of time aspects, problem of time facets, and various other foundational issues in quantum cosmology. That's all.